It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. Not only flurries in our skies across Iowa today, but a flurry of actions by Donald Trump. We want to talk about this hour in his first 6 days as president, I guess 5 days if you're not counting half days. Joining us to pick apart the last few days and the flurry of actions, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University and Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Thanks for coming into our Des Moines studio, Dennis.
Glad to be here, Ben.
Okay. Joining us by phone, obviously, there. Jeff Taylor, also by phone, professor of political science at Dort College in Sioux Center. Hello again, Jeff.
Good to be with you, Ben.
Good to be with you. Lots to talk about. We want to invite our listeners to join us, whether you're a Trump backer or perhaps a Trump basher or perhaps somewhere in the middle, waiting to weigh in with your judgment of this president. He has, after all, only been in office for less than a week. What's your view of the flurry of actions by President Trump during his first few days in office? Join us with a tweet at IPR Talk, or you can email us river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Of course, toll-free, 1-866-780-9100. Also, maybe a little bit later in the hour, I want to talk about your reaction to the Women's March on Saturday. I know many ears listening took part in marches. There were some 600 cities that had marches across the country. I think something like 3 million taking part. Is this the start of a movement? 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about what we heard on the top of the news at the top of the hour here. Donald Trump doubling down on his unsubstantiated assertion that millions of illegal immigrants gave Hillary Clinton her 2.8 million vote ballot victory in the popular vote, saying he would order a major investigation and tighten voting controls. That in a tweet. Here's Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, speaking at the White House press conference yesterday about Trump's beliefs about voter fraud.
The president does believe that. He has stated that before. I think he stated his concerns of voter fraud and people voting illegally during the campaign. And he continues to maintain that belief based on studies and evidence that people have presented to him.
Okay, studies and evidence. A follow-up there, question to the White House spokesman. Didn't reveal any studies that provided any evidence. Is there, Dennis Goldford, any widespread evidence or evidence of widespread fraud in this election? Our Congress did certify this election, didn't they?
Yes. I'd hate to have to dignify these unsubstantiated charges, but no, there is absolutely no evidence of any kind of credible, systematic, or organized or widespread voter fraud. A widely cited study before the election, when he kept claiming that it was going to be rigged, said that from 2000 to 2014, out of about a billion votes cast in federal elections, adding them all up, presidential, everything, and presidential years, midterm years, and so forth, there were roughly 35 credible stories of voter fraud, much of which was simply unintended or they didn't understand the rules. And Ari Melber on NBC this morning evidently said that out of close to 140 million votes in this past election, there might have been four aspects of voter fraud. To make this claim, you've got to impugn the integrity to a great extent of Republican and Republican-appointed voting officials in counties and states across the country, since Republicans control a majority of state governments around the country.
Okay, so Dennis, what is the motive here? What is behind it? We have to believe he truly believes this, don't we?
Well, he may well, and I'm going to make a provocative-sounding statement here with a little humorous edge to it, but it seems to me that Mr. Trump is a follower of Marx. And by Marx, I don't mean Karl, I mean Chico. And if you remember the line in Duck Soup with the Marx brothers, Chico Marx famously said, "Who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?" And he attempts to continue, and his people attempt to continue to argue things that simply are factually untrue. But when you do that, you destabilize people's confidence in any kind of objective truth, objective reality.
Okay.
That's part and parcel of the longstanding, not entirely without merit, conservative attack on mainstream media as in some way having a liberal bias. But in some ways, this goes so far as to devour its own children, and even Fox News and other outlets like that are in a little bit of trouble in this regard. But as an academic, this is something I simply find absolutely outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Taylor, do you have a different view, or do you line up with Dennis on this?
You know, I'm not outraged by it. To me, it's overreaching. It wouldn't surprise me that if there were some people who voted who were not citizens. I think it's more than single digits. Is it millions? No, I don't think it's millions. So I think, you know, in terms of state election officials, I think probably Trump is identifying the metro urban areas that tend to be run by Democrats. I think it's is it overstated? Yeah, I think it's overstated.
Overstated. Dennis quoted figures 35. Is it all right for a president to make claims for which he has no evidence?
Well, see, this is no, it's not.
Okay.
But the question is, what has he been told, or what has he seen? What Spicer wouldn't say. So I can't comment on that directly. I have no idea what's leading him to think this. I'm assuming it's anecdotal evidence, which is evidence of a sort, but obviously it's not the same as hard study. So I guess all I would say about this is that. To me, this is another one of those things where Trump is being thin-skinned, where he doesn't like the fact that he lost the popular vote. California made the difference. 49 states, he had a plurality over Clinton. California shifted, and I think he's trying to right that wrong that he sees. I think it's a vain attempt to do that. It's vain in both. It's going to be fruitless, and also I think it just kind of gets at some of his weaker personal traits, where he just cannot stand to have any kind of direct personal challenge to him. So I think it's even if this were all true, which I don't think it is, to launch this a week into his presidency seems like it's a very misguided effort.
Okay, Dennis, let me go back to you, because simply by Donald Trump saying there was voter fraud that changed the popular vote, we have polls that say that a lot of Americans, millions, tens of millions of Americans, believe there was voter fraud and that he actually did win the popular vote. Isn't then an investigation, as announced by Donald Trump via Twitter today, the correct step to clear this up so that we don't have two different realities, one true, one false? We get on the same page here.
Well, one of my reactions was, okay, investigate this and show it's not the case. On the other hand, if you are of a certain conspiratorial set of mind, if in fact, as one would expect, that it is found that there is no widespread or systematic voter fraud, that itself will be proof of the fact, the supposed fact, that's simply being covered up. So, with a conspiratorial mindset, you can't argue with that. You can't deal with that. But, you know, this is just...
So you're saying we have a conspiracy theorist as president?
Well, some of the things he says border on that. I mean, when you say numerous studies and surveys have shown this, they never give evidence. I mean, if I said that your wife is cheating on you, you're going to want some evidence of that. You're not just going to assume that what I say, well, that's plausible. No, you're going to want some evidence of it. And they never give evidence. And that's what's so outrageous and dangerous, I think, to the stability of our political system.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what we're expecting from Donald Trump today. Such a backlog of executive actions we could talk about, but we're expecting several executive actions today on immigration, including the border wall with Mexico, perhaps something about sanctuary cities, according to reporting. One of the actions expected to be taken, an executive order to direct federal funds toward the construction of this border wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Another one, a temporary ban on most refugees, and a suspension of visas for people from countries like Syria and six other Middle East countries. Jeff Taylor, Donald Trump making good on promises. Anything surprising here?
No, other than, I guess the surprise might be that he's moving so quickly on these areas, which, the merits of the policies can be debated, but yeah, I think that's right. He's making good on promises that he made, pulling out of the TPP, same kind of thing. And so, oftentimes presidents, you know, will make promises on the campaign trail and then either not follow through or they take their own time to follow through. And in this case, he's moving quickly.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, on this question of immigration and related executive actions, the president has it in his power to do all these things that are presumed we'll be hearing about in a few hours. He won't have to coordinate with Congress, which is under control of his own party, after all.
Well, consider there are a couple of things in what you said, but consider so much of what President Obama did was on the basis of his executive power, he claimed. One of the things was that when you're the chief executive, you're in charge ultimately with law enforcement, and you don't have infinite resources, and so you have to make priorities. And the difficulty there is you can't prosecute everybody. Well, President Obama said don't prosecute the DACA people, the so-called Dreamers. He decided he could do that on the basis of an executive order. I think that's a reasonable interpretation of the president's power in that regard. But the point is that President Trump can undo that, just as he undid the issue with regard to support for abortion-providing facilities around the world. You can do that and undo that with an executive order. We shouldn't be surprised that he's keeping promises so far, although, as Jeff said, it is pretty quick. But on the other hand, you know, one of the arguments that the Trump supporters had with regular Republicans was that, in their view, regular Republicans made all sorts of promises that they would get rid of the Affordable Care Act and they'd build the wall or stop illegal immigration and all these things if the voters just gave them control of the House and the Senate. Well, obviously you couldn't do that constitutionally because you need the president, but they made those promises. And in the view of Trump supporters, their anger with regular Republicans was you chose not to keep your promises. And so politically it's very astute of President Trump to go ahead and start work on keeping those promises, because the fact that the belief that regular Republicans didn't keep promises are a great deal of what got him made the Republican nominee as opposed to all the others.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University in Des Moines, Jeff Taylor of Dort College in Sioux Center, join us with your comment, your questions about the first flurry of actions by President Trump under in his first few days of office. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about the weekend following the inauguration on Friday. His first full day as president, Donald Trump said he had a, in his words, running war with the media. He accused journalists of underestimating the number of people who turned out Friday for his swearing in. Let's listen to Reince Priebus talking with host Chris Wallace, chief of staff. Reince Priebus talking with host Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday.
Because it's really not about crowd size. What it's about is honesty in the media. What it's about is, from day one after winning this election and President Trump talking about bringing America together, having a unified American public around unified ideas, not Republican or Democrat, he's ready to get to work. However, the media from day one has been talking about delegitimizing the election, talking about the Russians, talking about everything you can imagine except the fact that we need to move this country forward.
Okay. Do you buy that, Dennis? I don't think you do.
No. I mean, look, we can talk about the president as commander-in-chief, as diplomat-in-chief, various sorts of in-chief labels. But at one level, the president is interpreter-in-chief. One of the president's key jobs is to offer an account to the American people of what our problems are, what problems are important to solve, and how best ought we to go about dealing with those problems. Well, the uncomfortable thing for a president of any party, of any ideology, liberal, conservative, is that not just the other party offers its account or interpretation of what our problems are and how do we best go about solving them, but that's the role of the media, to hold elected officials of any and all parties accountable for what they say. And presidents of both parties or any parties, both here and around the world, don't like that rival account of what's going on in the world. And it's just exacerbated by Donald Trump's need to believe that he wins everything he puts his mind to.
Mm-hmm. That tension between the press and the president or those in office is put forth in our Constitution, Dennis.
That's right. That's right. And the danger is, I mean, even a lot of the conservative writers who were concerned about Donald Trump, others joined, but there were many concerned, and they were concerned that he represents with his populism a kind of Caesarism. That is, I'm the leader who exemplifies and manifests the will of the American people, and you should follow me even aside from the constitutional principles and structures of our political system. A lot of conservatives with concerns about Mr. Trump made those claims along the way. So it's not just the media, it's not just liberals. A lot of conservatives had that concern as well.
Let me play a clip. This is perhaps the clip of the week, or the past 7 days anyway. It's been quoted a lot just by the two words, alternative facts. Sunday, in a conversation with Meet the Press's Chuck Todd on NBC, Kellyanne Conway of the Trump administration argued that Press Secretary Sean Spicer gave alternative facts about the inauguration crowd, even though aerial photographs showed that the crowds were significantly smaller than 2009. Also, evidence backed up, not hard to prove this, Washington subway system showing exactly what those aerial photographs show. But here is that conversation between Chuck Todd and, or a portion of it, between Chuck Todd and Kellyanne Conway of the Trump administration.
Excuse
and
me,
it's still
it does
out
not
there.
Excuse, and you did not answer the question.
I did answer your question.
No, you
question.
Did not. You did
yes,
not answer
did.
The question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
no, it
on
doesn't.
Day
don't
one.
Be so, don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. What you're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The
hey,
one
Chuck,
thing he
why?
Got
hey,
right
Chuck.
Was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Okay, Jeff Taylor is the press in this case, in the form of Chuck Todd, doing its job, pressing for facts and refusing to accept all alternative facts as falsehoods.
Well,
or as not as falsehoods.
Yeah. Well, I sympathize and I support what Chuck Todd was doing there, at least up to a point. I agree. Alternative facts. I agree with his underlying point that those aren't facts. It's like an alternative reality. I think, you know, maybe she misspoke. Maybe you could make the case for alternative evidence. That's a different thing, or alternative. Details that would, you know, point in a different direction. But, yeah, alternative facts,
let me put it this way.
A bridge too far
Jeff Taylor, spin this out. We're talking about a crowd size, something inconsequential
right.
in inauguration crowd size. It has something to do with, I guess, ego, maybe not much past that. I guess it doesn't take too much thinking to say what happens when this alternative facts concerns something more than the inconsequential size of a crowd like this. What happens when it has to do with what's happened in, you know, what happens in Europe, what the Russians are doing or whatever?
Sure, sure. No, I agree it's problematic. I guess on the other hand, I would also say that in the case of the media, I don't think that a Chuck Todd or the major networks and certainly elements even of Fox News could claim to have been objective observers during the campaign or now. Usually presidents have a honeymoon period with the press. That didn't happen, is not going to happen. The major reporters, the editors, the owners, they were not Trump supporters. They clearly don't like him. They're not going to cut him a break. Even if he does something that is good or right or says something that's true, they're not going to acknowledge it. So they've got their own agenda going on, and that's part of the unfortunate thing. Dennis is right. There's often an adversarial relationship because the press is trying to They've got a different agenda than pushing a politician. But then on the other hand, I'm not sure that their agenda should be to constantly be opposing the politician either. Mm-hmm. So it's I'm sympathetic to the criticism of things like that that the Trump administration is doing. But then on the other hand, the press isn't exactly a neutral party in all of this either.
There's a false equivalence here, though. I think there's a false equivalence here, with all due respect to Jeff. I mean, you know, I'm not a journalism major. I'm not a journalism professor. But one of the great lines I ever heard was from a journalism professor was, and Ben, you may be familiar with this, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. That's the job of the journalist. You don't simply accept things as true. And that's an equal opportunity skepticism. That's not liberal. That's not conservative. That's not an ideological agenda. The point is, are people saying things that are true or not? And that's the job of journalists. But you have a candidate who's notoriously thin-skinned about any criticism, but you've got that where he successfully won election the way we define winning a presidential election in terms of electoral votes. There's no question about that legitimacy. He's pursuing or putting down the pedal, you know, putting the pedal to the metal with regard to the general critique and distrust of the media anyway, to make that useful to him. And his followers, again, very angry, fearful, alienated people, are very open to that kind of argument about mainstream media. I mean, he's the successful version of Sarah Palin, who coined the term lamestream media.
Dennis Goldford with us, Jeff Taylor. We're coming up on a break. Perhaps we can squeeze in one call. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Politics Wednesday welcomes Jim in Spencer. You're listening. Have to ask you to make it quick, Jim. But what's your point or your question?
So quick. Well, first of all, I just want to add before my comment. Well, I actually have two comments. I'm going to start
gotta
using
be quick.
Alternative math on my taxes. But I don't want people to insist that Donald stop tweeting. That's our inside line to his thinking.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody said he should stop tweeting. I guess, did you hear that?
I think they have. I've heard him say they should.
I guess the question that we have here on Politics Day is often, do his tweets amount to something he says? Are they something less than he says? Are they policy statements, you know, Jim? It's a good question. Well, it's a good area to probe.
It's worth consideration.
All right. Jim and Spencer, thanks for joining us. We'll be back in just a minute with more of our Politics Day. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jeff Taylor of Dort College in Sioux Center, picking apart the politics of the last few days. There have been plenty, too many for us to get to. We'll talk a little bit about Trump and his relationship with our intelligence agencies in this country. On Saturday, he gave a speech, had an outing at the CIA. We'll hear some excerpts of that when we come back. Also, an ethics lawsuit, leading legal advocacy groups challenging the president over alleged conflicts of interest. We'll talk with that. We'll hopefully have your question or comment about the first few days of President Trump. 1-866-780-9100. Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. Politics also on the docket for tomorrow, by the way. Politics in this country, we know, as those of us who are involved in Politics Wednesday especially, it hasn't always been as bitterly partisan as they are today, the politics of this country. My guest tomorrow, two former U.S. congressmen who have served Iowa. They did so during the 80s and 90s. Republican Jim Ross Lightfoot will be with us, as well as Democrat Dave Nagel. We'll discuss how political tactics, discourse have changed in Congress over the past 20 years, and with what implications. Tomorrow, a look back at a long view of politics and how we've changed in this country in Congress. We hope you'll join us for that. Dennis Goldford with us today of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University, where he's a professor and a chair of the Department of Political Science there. Jeff Taylor, political science professor at Dort College in Sioux Center. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We have a number of phone calls. Let's first go to Jeff. Jeff Kaufman is listening to us, a man who has been a guest on this program a few times, chair of the Republican Party of Iowa. I have the correct Jeff Kaufman on the line. Is that right on my screen?
Yes, I'm the chair of the Republican Party.
All right. Jeff, you've been listening to our program. What's your reaction to what we've been talking about in the first half?
Well, I think, although I have a great deal of respect for Professor Goldberg, he seems to be acting as the Democratic chair in Iowa and giving his slant on analysis. I thought maybe he'd want another academic with a PhD and all the resume to give maybe a Republican slant on things, because that's definitely not objective analysis that I'm hearing.
Okay, okay. You know, Jeff, we have other callers, but I'm glad you're calling. Be specific. What do you specifically disagree with?
I am going to. For instance, painting Trump supporters as conspiratorial and implying that any kind of investigation, which I think is merited, is just going to not be accepted anyway, plants an idea that no matter what, as Dennis has said, that Trump's always going to come out on top and win. I think the people that disagree with him, when you set that up with that premise, is going to do that as well. Number two, saying that the crowd size is all about ego. Well, I think it's also about plant and making sure to make the point that the Trump crowd size is smaller. So I think there was some motive on both sides. The interpretation of the First Amendment, I don't think Trump has ever said that the press does not have the right to hold accountable. What we're talking about here is the professionality of the journalist and even attempts to be relatively neutral in their questioning and question Trump as they did President Obama and vice versa. Nobody in the Republican Party and no one that is a Trump supporter is questioning the right of the media to question. What we are questioning is, I think, the almost inarguable fact that President Trump is being treated differently both during the interim period before he was nominated or before he was took the oath of office and now. And I think it's almost inarguable that there is a difference in terms of tone, in terms of leading questions, in terms of the viciousness and the attack-oriented questions and carrying that out.
Okay.
Now, that would be a little bit more palatable if the same thing was done to President Obama. So those would be just a very few. I could probably go on and list 10 things.
It sounds like you can, Jeff. We have limited time. Thank you for calling in, Jeff. I want to get Dennis Goldford, since you named him specifically, to react to your assertions there.
Members of both parties will always say, oh, yes, we respect the First Amendment. We respect the right of the press to criticize the president. It's just tends to be the case that whenever there is negative comment or criticism or analysis, the immediate reaction is that, oh, well, this must be this is not objective, this is biased in some way. So there's lip service to the First Amendment. But I mean, look, none of us likes to be criticized. There's no question about that. But we have in this case a president who, by wide agreement, which I think is not a partisan position, is very sensitive to criticism, very sensitive to claims that he might not have won by as much as he believes he won by. But again, we can solve all this. And I did say in regard to Jeff's comment, yes, my first reaction was, yes, let's go ahead and investigate this, and we hope put this to rest. My concern was that there might be some people for whom this will not put it to rest. It will just be further proof of, in their mind, that the fix is in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dennis Goldford, thank you. Jeff Kaufman disappeared from the line there. Thank you, Jeff, again for calling. Chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, with your feedback. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about Trump in the CIA. We remember we have a history here of Donald Trump talking about the CIA in unflattering terms, also asking, are we part of Nazi? Am I experiencing Nazi Germany when we had assertions of Russian influence, putting the thumb on the scale for Donald Trump during the campaign? Here is Donald Trump at the CIA on Saturday. He said the news media had constructed this feud between him and the intelligence community. His words, they sort of make it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. He said it was exactly the opposite, and they understood that, too. Let's listen to a little bit of Donald Trump on Saturday. And here he is. The setting is important. He is standing in front of the CIA Memorial Wall of Heroes, which honors the agency's fallen officers.
This is my first stop, officially. We're not talking about the balls, and we're not talking about even the speeches. Although they did treat me nicely on that speech yesterday. I always call them the dishonest media, but they treated me nicely. But I want to say that there is nobody that feels stronger about the intelligence community and the CIA than Donald Trump. There is nobody in America. And the wall behind me is very, very special. We've been touring for quite a while. And I'll tell you what, 29? I can't believe it. Oh, 28. We've got to reduce it. But that's amazing. And we really appreciate what you've done in terms of showing us something very special. And your whole group, these are really special, amazing people. Very, very few people could do the job you people do. And I want to just let you know, I am so behind you. And I know maybe sometimes you haven't gotten the backing that you've wanted. And you're going to get so much backing. Maybe you're going to say, please don't give us so much backing. Mr. President, please, we don't need that much backing.
Okay, the president putting himself there as a big fan of U.S. intelligence agencies, even though we remember he repeatedly criticized the same agencies during his transition to office, questioned their conclusion that Russian meddled in the election to aid his candidacy, called their assessment ridiculous, suggested that it had been politically motivated, compared the U.S. intelligence agencies to creating something like they had in the Third Reich. Jeff Taylor, what do you see going on with this making up with our intelligence agencies here?
Well, some of it seems a bit disingenuous to me. But on the other hand, I guess you could also make the argument that maybe his criticism during the campaign was toward the higher, ranking Obama appointees who head the agency, and that may be different from the rank and file agents that predominantly.
But this was after he won the election. He compared it to Nazi Germany.
Right. But again, you could say, who was driving, those leaks? Who was driving that information that was getting out there into the media? Was it the average CIA employee, or was it the director of Central Intelligence? You could make a distinction between, the majority of the people in the room there and the people that are higher ranking that were appointed by Obama, and maybe they have some kind of a political
motive. I see what you mean.
Some of the stuff they were doing.
Dennis Goldford, another view?
Well, again, the issue comes down to similar to what we've been talking about. If you say something in one place and you say something contradictory of it in another place, the problem is, how do you reconcile the contradictions? What you can't do is, if you said both these things, is deny that you said one of them, if there in fact is evidence on video, audio, written evidence. What's objectionable is the attempt, again, as I said about Chico Marx, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? And that's what's very disturbing and problematic, and I hope it does not continue.
Okay. Join us with your comments, your questions, as we wind up another Politics Day. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jeff Taylor of Dort College, Rachel tweeting, Donald Trump had a chance to unify the country after the Women's March that took place on Saturday in Washington, D.C., of course, but in many cities across the country, including here in Iowa. Rachel tweets, what did he choose? He had a chance to unify. What did he choose? He chose to criticize. Jeff Taylor, what do you make of the what we saw on Saturday, the demonstrations across the country and in Washington, D.C.? The question of is certainly a demonstration, a large demonstration, but was it more than that, the beginning of a movement, do you think?
I would be surprised if I would call that a movement, but to me it was a healthy development where you have, I've heard at least a million, maybe it was more than that, maybe several million, predominantly grassroots, predominantly women, but also some men coming out and exercising their freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, all of that. I think that's very healthy. I do, in terms of the listener comment, I do disagree with the idea that Trump had a chance to unify the country after that that march. It wasn't, the marchers are not looking for Trump to unify them. I think generally speaking, they hate him, they fear him, they're angry about it. I don't think they're in a place where anything that the new president would say is going to bring them on board at this point. So that's probably putting a little too much burden on him. But I think the idea of Americans, regardless of what their point of view is, coming out and joining together is a healthy sign.
Dennis Goldford, did Trump, as the listener suggested, miss an opportunity to unify in his reaction to those marches?
Well, he gave a version of the speech he gave at the convention when he accepted the nomination. It was a very dark speech. It was a very fear-inspiring speech, while at the same time saying, essentially, I will save you from all this. And in fact, he literally said that at the convention. George Will argued this was a terrible inaugural. A longtime conservative writer, Peter Weiner, longtime Republican office holder and activist, said he could never and will never support Trump. So again, there's concern not just on the liberal side. But I think that the march in response, it remains to be seen what happens. I mean, the Tea Party movement was a successful movement. In many ways, Donald Trump is the Tea Party president. Occupy Wall Street really never got very far. And when I saw the march on Saturday, it was very interesting in terms of how widespread it was and how many people turned out. But to some extent, I thought of that awful case when the rebel group, the vicious rebel group in Nigeria, kidnapped, those 200 schoolgirls, and they've still never been found, although some have been released. But then all of a sudden, folks here in this country in the West got on social media and Twitter or whatever they do, bring our girls home, and it made all of them feel good, but it didn't accomplish anything. So the task for the people who are on the side of those who demonstrated on Saturday, if you support that group, you've got to do something more than just feel good from having done that. The question is, what are you going to do about it concretely?
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Just a few minutes left. Liesl emailing, who's listening. Trump's early moves are troubling and confusing, Liesl writes, attempting to call a lie a fact and to discredit agencies that do their darndest to present facts clearly to the American public are wrongheaded political moves. Come on, writes Liesl. Scott is joining us, listening to Iowa Public Radio in southern Minnesota. Hi, Scott. Glad to have you on board here for the waves, radio waves coming from across the border.
Well, it's always a good sign that IPR reaches far.
All right, great. What do you have on your mind on this Politics Wednesday?
More of a comment than a question, but I think if you listen to the discourse that's been going on the whole time, there's one thing that's clearly evident. It's evident when you think about the listeners that have called in with some of their opinions. It's certainly evident when you look at what's happening. And that, I think, as Americans, we've forgotten how to listen. And when we forget how to listen and we're talking to someone and we're feeling like we're not being heard, we become more and more obsessed with making our point. We get more vitriolic. We use more hyperbole. And I think if we could just step back and recognize that it doesn't matter if we're left or right, that folks have valid opinions, and start from that as a premise, we would have less of this escalation to where folks feel the need to put out alternative facts.
Yeah, Scott, the trouble is we're self-segregating. I don't know about you, but we have studies that show we're pulling into groups of like-minded people. We're not talking across political lines as much as we used to, are we, Scott?
No, I could not agree with you more, and I think that is driven by the fact that we don't want to listen. We want to only hear what we want to hear. We're not comfortable with hearing anyone else's thoughts. We instantly think that it's delegitimized, and if we don't move away from that, we're going to move to a very dangerous place as a society.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for your view. Scott, Dennis, we've talked about this aspect many times on this program, but there's no clear path toward more conversation, more cross line.
Well, you know, I think I've mentioned a story from the 96 campaign when Jack Kemp, who used to call himself a bleeding heart conservative, a term bleeding heart often used mostly for liberals, at a rally when one of his fellow Republicans said, "We got to go out and defeat our enemies, the Democrats." And Kemp said, "No, you're wrong. The Democrats aren't our enemies. They're our opponents. We're all Americans." And that was a tremendously patriotic and classy position to take. And my fear for quite some time is that we don't live in that country anymore. I mean, the central ability to the necessary condition of people being willing to listen is that you accept the honorable intentions of the other person. In other words, the other person is not treasonous, not a traitor, not trying to undermine the country, just has different views of how to get what's best for the country or different views of what might be best for the country. It's that willingness to accept the other side as legitimate. And what's happened over the past decade or so, partly through the polarization of the media and politicians' exploitation of that, is that we have less and less a sense that the other side is well-intentioned and just as patriotic as we are.
Let's try to squeeze in at least one more call here on Politics Wednesday. Ron is in Iowa City. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
There are two things coming up right now that are deeply disturbing. First of all, this president is talking about reopening black sites. That's been teased out, and it's likely going to happen in the next day or two. And the idea that the EPA staffers are not they're under a gag order, and that same word is going out to Health and Human Services and others. And how can these agencies function if they can't talk to our congressmen, if they can't talk to us or our senators? It's very disturbing, and I'll take your comments on the air. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ron, for calling in. A quick thing, I assume he means by black sites, the interrogation sites found not on U.S. Soil. Let's talk about that quickly. Dennis, anything on that? I haven't been reading very much on that.
Well, I don't have enough information to be able to comment. I just want to see how it's going to turn out.
Okay, let's talk about the other thing that Ron in Iowa City mentioned. The Trump administration moving to curb the flow of information from several government agencies. We've heard all of them involved in environmental issues, it seems, the EPA, the Interior Department, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health and Human Services, seen directives from the leadership to limit how they communicate with the public. I wonder, Jeff Taylor, to what degree is this normal for an incoming administration to do this until they have their policies in place and have them communicated down the chain of command? To a certain extent, this is normal, isn't it, or not?
I would assume that it is. I think, you know, every president wants to leave their mark on the bureaucracy. It's usually not very successful. There's always this tension between the political appointees at the top and the, the lower levels, civil service or professional people who have a career, you know, in these different departments and agencies. And so I wouldn't expect that this is so out of the ordinary. But on the other hand, I agree with the caller that it can be troubling if people are just trying to do their job, and then, you know, the president has this a chilling effect of saying, no, stop. I don't want to hear anything that goes against my agenda.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, I guess the question is there evidence that any of these actions have been designed to discourage dissenting views? Is that a question here, Dennis?
Well, you know, any organization by its own imperatives wants to be able to control information and make sure that everybody's on the same page and there are contradictions between what one side's saying and another side in the same organization. And you don't want anybody to undermine the direction charted by the leadership. That's any organization. So I think that it's just simply there's being more attention paid to this now, I think, because of what already appears to be the more antagonistic relationship than usual between this administration and the press.
Okay. Quickly, before we have to go, this is going to be real quick. Congressional Republicans, their annual retreat today in Philadelphia, their party dominates Congress. What's the outlook for the GOP in working with their new president, Jeff, quickly?
I think the agenda that Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan have is not necessarily the agenda Trump has. So I think there's going to be, they're putting a happy face on it right now. But I think there's going to be continued, probably behind the scenes and eventually maybe open conflicts between the two.
Okay. Dennis, is that a similar prediction that you would have?
Yeah, Jeff has it right. We have to remember that, in effect, the Trump candidacy was a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. And he just sort of came in with a different agenda. And one of the most interesting things to look at as time goes by is the relations not between the Trump administration and the Republicans and the Democrats, but the relationship between the Trump administration and the Republican majorities in each House.
Okay, thank you very much. Politics Wednesday once again has drawn to a close. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, and Jeff Taylor, political science professor at Dort College in Sioux Center. Jeff, Taylor, Dennis Goldford, thank you for being on our program and sharing your views.
You bet. Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Tomorrow on the program, well, we think back to a time when politics aren't as bitterly partisan as they are today. We'll talk with two former U.S. congressmen who served Iowa in the 80s and 90s, Republican Jim Ross Lightfoot and Democrat Dave Nagel. They'll discuss how political tactics and discourse in Congress have changed over the past 20 years and what implications that has. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.